Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
On budgeting, genuinely, I think we should budget for years 1, 2, and 50. Because the value of the 10th year budget estimate is zero. The standard around it's got to be 7,000. I mean,
to take a very precise number.
I mean,
former director of the CBO, Doug Holtz-Eakin.
But what you want to know is what are we doing? What's the plan that this Congress has to execute on? And are we on track? And we know we're not on track. You know, we look at the year 50, we are wildly off track. And so things need to be fixed. The actual numbers in between don't have a great deal of value. They just tell us we're off track. So I'm not a huge fan of formalizing it into the budget committees and the budget process year 27. That doesn't seem to me value added.
This is Agriculture Today.
The farm bill process is a five-year process. Everybody knows this. Unless it kind of continues on through extensions, but we're hopeful that it won't be that way.
Cody Besant is CEO of Lubbock-based Plains Cotton Growers.
Everybody is getting really ramped up to start the chairman's mark, hopefully by the end of May, as he has indicated in public settings. And I think folks will be very proud of what has been developed the last several years of industry talks and trying to ramp up a more viable safety net for producers. You mentioned the seed cotton program. You know, a key component of that is we're working very diligently to try to marginalize the seed cotton reference price or bring it up to par of where it costs to do business today. I think we'll get there when it's all said and done. Same for the marketing loan program, trying to modernize it and bring it up to more status quo of where cost of doing business is at today. A key component we've talked about before is, you know, currently today, if you participate in stacks, you're ineligible for participation in Title I. And so we're trying to make some remedies of that and modernize that.
Cotton is also a bit unique because once you lose infrastructure, you don't get it back.
The infrastructure has really been struggling for various reasons, but the main reason is because of the lack of crop. And so we're working on trying to develop some sort of a risk management tool that industry can take advantage of. So in the event, if we get back into a year like we've seen in 2022 and 2023, unfortunately, and we will see some of those at some point in time again, but we'll have the risk management tools in place that industry can combat that and still survive going into a new crop year.
But is it safe to say that the farm bill is coming? And soon?
It's coming, and we're ready. And we're going to be pushing and advocating alongside the chairman, alongside the ranking member, both the Senate and the House, in order to secure a bill that producers and industry alike can be very proud of at the end of the day. Some of the politics in play that come in and out of that is obviously we're in an election cycle, so there's some dynamics we have to play with in there. There's some other high-level pieces of legislation that they have to get done. You know, by example, they just finished the defense authorization bill over the weekend. And so now that that's kind of cleared the deck, that really sets the tempo and the pace for how we can get a bill done on time before the end of the calendar year to make sure that producers know what's there for them from a safety net standpoint. Their lenders know what's there for a safety net standpoint. And a lot of security being built into this process. So there's going to be some nicks along the way and some challenges. We're prepared to address those as we get geared up. But I do ultimately want to say that I do believe at the end of the day, the policy that will be adopted, that producers, members alike, will be very proud of that. And it will reflect where we're at as far as cost of doing business today.
That's all on the House side, but it also has to clear the Senate.
You have the chairwoman that is retiring from the Senate, and certainly this would be a great way for her to exit the Senate gracefully and creating a robust farm bill that works for everyone. And so once the chairman in the House, T.T. Thompson, marks his bill up and receives from a legislative standpoint floor time to move it forward, I do think you'll start seeing a lot more commotion and action in the Senate. They're working largely behind the scenes, which is great, getting ready and getting geared up. They just want to see the process move forward and then kind of can react and come together on a conference and negotiate some of the differences out.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
If you told me that debt to GDP ratios were going to be high forever at a number, let's say 150 forever, I actually think that that world might be a fine world.
Last week at the National Press Club, Natasha Sarin, president of the Budget Lab at Yale.
The challenge is whether or not we know, sort of from a trajectory perspective, we know the direction spending is going. We know the direction our demographics are going. What we don't know is whether we are going to find the political will to be able to raise revenues to meet those spending needs.
The discussion centering on what will the country do when the tax cuts disappear next year.
If you look at the sort of estimates of and the research that's been done, there's a great new paper by Gabe Charter-Reich at Harvard, Owen Zadar, Eric Swick, and Matt Smith, who's at Treasury, where they kind of try to sort of scope out the extent to which you've seen the increases in investment and the increases in capital formation that you would expect, sort of textbook, that you expect when you see substantial corporate rate cuts, when you see 100% bonus depreciation, when you see these expensing provisions that were central tenets of TCJA. And what you see, the textbook stuff is true, but it's also true. And so you do. You see an increase in investment. You see what you're expecting. But what's true is that they are so outweighed by the static revenue loss of a 14% corporate rate cut that in aggregate, you're actually not seeing some of the effects that Josh is talking about as he pushes for and he totally rightfully is focused on making this country and making corporations in this country sort of a competitive and driving force of economic growth. And I say all of these things because I am sort of animated by the idea that there is a lot of scope to design tax packages that are pro-growth, that are creating a level playing field, not just here in the United States, but with respect to Pillar 2 and the OECD and international tax reform that puts multinationals on a level playing field so you can't just decide which jurisdiction to operate in and kind of pick paying 0% as your preferred tax rate. But also one that recognizes that as we're grappling with some of these fiscal concerns and our concerns about debts and deficits, like thinking seriously about the ways that corporate tax reform can help us address some of those concerns, like, has to be part of the conversation. And I think that I actually think Josh, like, broadly, he probably doesn't agree with the particulars. And if we sat down together, we probably wouldn't design a package that was like identical or to that was sort of our dream. In either one of our versions, but I think talking through some of those trade-offs seriously seems like hugely important. And it's hugely important for one of the reasons Josh said, which is like earlier this week, Jamie Dimon sort of wrote in his letter to shareholders that like JP Morgan is preparing for medium-term interest rates that could be somewhere from 2% to 8%. So steep fiscal costs that government is bearing and the feedback loop to higher interest rates faced not just by companies, but by American households as you're looking to like buy a car or buy a house. These are real concerns that are animating the corporate community and totally rightfully so. I just think that we should be having a holistic conversation about the ways in which to address them that thinks about both sides of the ledger very seriously.
President of the Budget Lab, Natasha Sarin. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The last time you came before this committee, I was very optimistic about the work that we could accomplish together to deliver some real results for American workers, farmers, and manufacturers.
Missouri's Jason Smith, chair of the Ways and Means Committee, last week addressing Trade Ambassador Catherine Tai.
Unfortunately, today, I'm less optimistic. As the administration has continued to pursue a trade agenda that ignores Congress to the detriment of the American worker and American leadership on trade. The Ways and Means Committee has held field hearings across the United States where we've heard about how the administration has failed to secure our critical supply chains, level the playing field for American farmers and workers, and reassert America's global leadership role. The United States is rapidly losing ground to China. We must act quickly to right the ship and put workers and American job creators at the center of an effective trade agenda. This starts with strict enforcement of all our existing trade agreements, especially the USMCA agreement. Unfortunately, the Biden administration has failed for the last 3 years to hold our trading partners accountable. It took years of congressional engagement to finally get this administration to bring a case against Mexico GMO corn ban. To make matters worse, when I speak to farmers in my home state of Missouri, they often refer to America as the world's breadbasket. But lately, they feel more like the world's cash cow. You can understand my concern when the U.S. agriculture trade deficit reached a staggering $21 billion. $21 billion in 2023. This is even more alarming when you compare it to the years when President Trump was in office, where the average trade surplus for agriculture products was over $5.2 billion. U.S. agriculture producers benefit when the administration aggressively pursues a trade agenda that prioritizes their interest, and when USTR goes to bat for them around the world. USTR must be far more aggressive in protecting the interest of American farmers. Meanwhile, this administration has sat idly by while China continues to spread its malign global influence. You've asked for new tools in that fight, but you haven't even used the tools that you already have. You have failed to enforce the Phase One agreement, despite knowing that China is violating its end of the agreement. This administration has pursued no new cases at the WTO, no new Section 301 investigations. To top it off, we are now nearly 6 years into a four-year review of President Trump's tariffs. Maybe it's time for the Biden administration to just admit that he did something right. The Ways and Means Committee stands ready to hold China accountable for its human rights abuses and predatory trade practices that devastate American jobs and communities. Rather than work to deliver for American workers, farmers, and small businesses, the administration appeases progressive activists to make trade woke and surrenders U.S. leadership on priorities like digital trade. Let me be clear. We would prefer to work closely together to achieve these goals. And it's not too late to start. We remain willing to work with USTR to realign America's trade priorities and look forward to hearing your answers to our questions today.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I have the second largest ag district in the country, corn, soybeans being the priority, along with cattle, hogs, dairy, eggs, you name it, turkeys.
Iowa Representative Randy Feenstra, member of the House Ag Committee and the Ways and Means Committee, where he questioned Trade Ambassador Catherine Tai.
First of all, I just want to say, do everything you can on the Mexico issue on GMO corn. I mean, 40% of our corn exports to Mexico. I can't tell you how big of an issue this is, and there's a lot of worry in the markets right now where this is headed. The downward pressure in the commodity market on corn is reflecting this issue with corn, you know, it got below four just about a month ago. That also brings up the topic, you know, and you've heard from everybody about market access. I get that, and I heard all your points. But it really affects ag, especially, you know, when you talk about corn and soybeans and pork and dairy and cattle, the downward pressure on the commodity markets. I heard what you said about the trade deficit, that it's got ebb and flows. But here's my issue is that we're seeing individual states doing individual trade deals with different countries. And I struggle to square this up. If other countries can do this with individual states, why can't our federal government do some of this? And I'd like you to answer that. I mean, why are we lagging behind, especially even our global partners? I mean, our global partners, China has done 10 new agreements. Japan has done 7 new agreements. The EU, 8. Canada, 8. And we haven't done anything since the last USMCA. So could you expound on that?
Thank you, Mr. Feenstra, and appreciate the significant footprint your district has in our nation's agricultural production. I think this is a fair question. It's one that I come upon quite often, so I'm always willing to engage. The first place is just to assert that you and I are on the same team with respect to U.S. farmers and agricultural producers, the big ones all the way to the small family farmers. They feed us. They are able to feed the world. The second piece is to look at the way that we've done trade traditionally. And you've heard me say we need to do trade in a way that stops pitting Americans against other Americans. One of the things about the traditional free trade agreement is that it has done very, very well for ag, American ag, especially big ag. But it's actually not done well for our heavy industries, our industrial workers. And that's created this this pitting of Americans against each other. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to continue to score wins for American ag. Yeah. We've done it with India. We've done it in these singles and our doubles. But at the same time, what we need to do is stand up for our industries, because the FTAs that we've negotiated have been much more strategic for farmers than the industry.
Yep. Thank you. I hear that, American for Americans, and it's a bit rhetorical rhetoric there. I struggle with it. I struggle with it because no one in the ag industry is seeing a lot of it's nothing's getting done, and you know that's where our commodity markets struggle, and it's serious. I want to switch gears. I also share concern with my colleagues on USTR's decision related to digital trade rules. Without the longstanding digital trade rules, local data storage requirements will proliferate, and countries will essentially require U.S. companies to invest in building facilities in those countries as a requirement for them to do business there. This creates significant implications for our tax base, our economy, our company's taxable profits are shifted to other countries. You know, you talk about American and American. Just a quick note, I always want to remind everybody that businesses create jobs, businesses create the economy. All right, and that's lost in this administration, and it's lost in these rules. And I'm very scared about that, and we all should be.
Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I think the reality is, if you look at, for example, reconciliation as like a process, it has requirements built in for what the second decade looks like from a revenue perspective.
Dr. Natasha Sarens, president of the Budget Lab at Yale, looking at the nation's debt.
We are depending on some of these numbers. And the thing that I find sort of troubling, or I find difficult, and again, this is to no fault of, I want to be like super explicit, I like fully agree with Doug, and I'm not sure whether this work should happen at CBO, this work should happen at the Budget Lab, this work should happen at another government institution that's not CBO. I don't know the answers. But what I'll say is that there is a tendency to, and I found this when I've done a lot of academic work on invest in the IRS and then what happens. And one of the things that happens when you invest in the IRS and have them audit more high-end taxpayers is that the high-end taxpayers look at their neighbors who are getting audited, and they're more likely to adjust their behavior in response to the fact that they're observing more people get audited. And the corporations that are watching, that they have the same tax planners, and they're saying, oh, this corporation got audited for doing that, you're likely to get audited in the same way. There are just like behavioral aspects that matter and that bear on even what in the short run and certainly in the long run the sort of expectation is from some of the investments that we make in tax administration today in terms of revenue collection in the future. All of these estimates are not like, there's not like some magic in the precision of them. They're all built on a series of assumptions, and the assumptions are hard and difficult and challenging even in the short run, let alone in the long run. But not grappling with them, and that's part of why I think the Budget Lab is adding value, by just showing you. It's like democratizing the budget process. That's how we conceive of ourselves. Just showing you the set of choices that are being made and the set of choices we're making and why we're making them. I think like sunlight is best disinfectant in some sense, will add some value to the overall process. But I take Doug's point very deeply. Like, I am very sensitive to where exactly this sort of cost-benefit analysis should be happening. And I'm not sure I know the right answer for the set of reasons that Doug laid out, but also, frankly, for capacity constraint reasons. Like, there is a lot of work that CBO and JCT are doing day in and day out to even be able to produce what they produce today. And asking them to do all of the other stuff that we envision would be useful from a policy analysis perspective is really putting them in a totally different space than they've been.
Douglas Holtz-Eakins, the former director of the CBO.
We conducted the first dynamic score under my tenure at CBO, and we invested a lot of time in looking at it in different ways and showing different ways to do the analysis and what answer you got. And I thought, this is great. We're going to teach Congress so much about how they do their business. And their conclusion was that we didn't know what we were doing because it was all over the map. And I thought they'd learned that if you paired 2003 tax cuts with the prescription drug program, they'd cancel each other. They concluded we did it wrong. I mean, that's it. So when you set up the budget lab and allow people to learn about this stuff, do not think it's going to be members of Congress. That belongs outside. They're not there to learn. And they're busy people. They have a job, and it's not figuring out the models.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Ambassador Tai, I'm going to be very blunt. This administration's trade agenda does not exist.
Beth Van Dyne is a representative from Texas, a member of the House Ways and Means Committee, last week with Trade Ambassador Catherine Tai.
The administration is not holding China accountable. Trade enforcement's weak, and we've basically surrendered in areas such as digital trade. Earlier, you said you objected with my colleagues, saying you and your team are standing up to China, particularly at the WTO. But time and time again, actions speak louder than words. And I don't think you can truly defend these policies and honestly say that the USTR is actually pursuing an agenda that wins for America and disadvantages our adversaries. You defended IPEF and actions of the WTO as pushing back against China, but IPEF is a framework. It is not a true free trade deal. I mean, last time you testified, the buzzword was and ah, and this time it's been soon, which is equally as helpful and informative. So the question I've got is, does this administration actually plan to enter into a free trade agreement? And I would ask you to please be specific. Soon is not an answer.
Congresswoman, I disagree with almost everything that you've just said, and I think it's actually a tremendous sign of disrespect that you don't see the trade agenda that is so clearly before you.
Well,
we are not negotiating.
Position,
I'm sorry,
Tai,
you asked me a question.
As you know, we don't have any of these have real teeth.
Free trade agreements, as we've engaged with them in the past, have pitted Americans against Americans, and we are not doing that anymore.
I retake my time. So last year you had
She asked me questions that presumably she wanted me to answer.
But
she doesn't want me to answer them. I don't
need
to respond.
It's Mrs. Van Dyne's time.
Last year we had to do this backward to ensure that we actually supported our ally in Taiwan. Is the UTR and this administration intentionally avoiding Congress? And do you really care about the constitutional process? And a yes or no answer would just be great. Okay? Non-responsive. We'll send it in a letter. Last summer, you stated that the Biden administration's trade policy is, I quote, turning the colonial mindset on its head. And last November, you opened an APEC meeting by acknowledging that it was being held on the, quote, unceded ancestral homeland of the Rematush Ohlone. I mean, I thought it was called San Francisco, but whatever. Then at a conference in Brussels earlier this year, you called for, quote, breaking out of some of these colonial and post-colonial structures. This entire time, the Biden administration has not lifted a finger to enforce China's violations of the Phase One agreement, but I guess you considered it more important to travel the world talking about unceded land and post-colonial structures than to hold China accountable for its unfair trade practices. I continue to hear from my constituents on concerns over the inability of our trade tools to address massive subsidies from China and other countries that dump products and unfairly enter the U.S. market. In your nomination hearing, you expressed the need for new tools to address these new threats to American industries. Last week, I sent you a letter laying out concerns on the aluminum extrusions. Given the serious concerns raised in the aluminum extrusions case, why are new trade tools not being utilized to initiate an investigation into whether Mexican aluminum extruders received unwrought aluminum for less than the market rate from governments of China and Russia?
Ms. Van Dyne, I'd be happy to respond in writing. I find your approach to this question session to be disrespectful and unserious.
Excellent. All right. I look forward to getting your because we haven't really gotten responses at all during this hearing, which I find very frustrating as a member of Congress when we ask questions, and the best that we can get is soon and hopeful and optimistic answers.
Ms. Van Dyne, I'm sure there are issues that we agree on. I don't know what you stand for, and I don't know who your constituents are.
So,
but if
I'm,
I can understand
I'm
better,
you,
if I can understand
will
better
you commit
who you are championing,
an investigation
then I would be happy
China's
to work with
unfair
you.
Subsidy practices. So you can't answer whether or not you will actually do the job of investigating China's unfair subsidy practices?
No, I choose to engage respectfully with people who will treat me the same way.
So you can't give me an answer on
that? No, I choose not to.
All right, thank you very much. I'll yield back.
Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The number of cattle on feed on April 1st was about 11.8 million head, which was about 1% above a year ago.
USDA livestock analyst Shel Shagan.
During March, about 1.7 million head of cattle were placed, which was about 12% below 2023. During March, feedlots marketed about 1.7 million head of cattle, which was about 14% below a year ago. However, that has to be adjusted by the fact there were two fewer slaughter days during March. When you make those adjustments, the marketings on a per-day basis were actually about 5% below a year ago. The report also gave us a breakout by sex of the cattle on feed on April 1st, which gives us an indication of the proportion of those animals on feed were heifers and heifer calves. And on April 1st, 2024, there were just under 4.6 million head of heifers and heifer calves on feed, which was about 1% above a year ago, but as a proportion of the number of total animals on feed was about 38.5% compared to about 38.7% a year earlier.